Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's entertaining and accessible. If we can understand it, so can you. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with my co-host John Wells. Today on the program, we'll speak with Dr. Dalia Kirschbaum of NASA about a new satellite mission recently launched that will set a new standard for measuring precipitation from space. Could it be that weather prognostication will become more accurate? Stay tuned to find out.
And good morning, Lynn. Our second guest, Jacob Lowenstern. He's the scientist in charge of the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. Now, you've probably heard about the supervolcanoes in the news recently. Well, a couple weeks ago, magnitude 4.8 earthquake struck the area, giving rise to questions about the reinvigoration of rumblings atop one of the world's largest subterranean volcanoes. That happens to be in our backyard.
That's right. All that plus today's cool story after this. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Katie Wang, Executive Director of the Park City Film Series, inviting you to check out our winter calendar of films at parkcityfilmseries.org. We have lots of great films and a new digital projector thanks to your support. So please join us on Friday or Saturday nights at 8 p.m. or Sundays at 6 p.m. at the Jim Santee Auditorium, 1255 Park Avenue. Park City Film Series is a nonprofit organization.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake here with John Wells. Well, in late February, NASA and the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency, otherwise known as JAXA, launched the GPM Core Observatory satellite. What this new satellite will do is give us a new standard for precipitation measurements from space. Now, the mission will help advance our understanding of Earth's water and energy cycles. It'll improve forecasting of extreme natural disasters. And, well, we're wondering, like you probably, if it can forecast the weather more accurately. Joining us to tell us all about it from NASA is Dr. Dalia Kirschbaum. Dr. Kirschbaum, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And this new satellite has been called a game changer. It's said to that it will help fill massive gaps in precipitation observation. And we're sort of wondering why and how. I mean, how, maybe if you start by telling us how it differs from the satellites, the weather satellites we already have out there.
Sure. So the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission, or GPM, has a core observatory that was launched, as you said, by NASA and JAXA in late February. Now, what makes the satellite so unique is it actually has the most advanced instruments on board to measure precipitation, everything from light rain to heavy rain and snow. And so by being able to look in new perspectives at precipitation, you know, looking at using an instrument, for example, called a dual-frequency precipitation radar that looks three-dimensionally through the clouds, kind of like a CAT scan of the body, and layer by layer, we can tell the types of drops in the clouds and the structure, which is really important for everything from understanding, for example, what's happening in a hurricane developing, where it might intensify, where you have the strongest convection or precipitation, and then looking all the way up to higher latitudes, you know, what's happening with extratropical storms or snow systems, right, you know, in our backyard. And the second instrument is actually kind of like an X-ray, where it gets all of the information together, and together these two instruments can provide a much more accurate picture of what we're experiencing in terms of weather and how that kind of relates to climate long term.
Very interesting. Okay, so we have this X-ray ability and this dual frequency kind of 3D ability to look at water and precipitation. How does that differ from what we currently do?
It's interesting because this satellite is what we're calling the anchor to a lot of other satellites that either are already up or are going to be launched soon. And these are both from domestic partners, like the Department of Defense and NOAA, as well as other partners internationally, like the European Space Agency and JAXA. And so together, different satellites. They are in different orbits, and they look at different perspectives of precipitation. And they're going to give us this global view of precipitation everywhere in the, around the world every 3 hours. So if you think of the GPM core satellite, which was just launched, as kind of like the lead violinist in an orchestra, it helps to tune the measurements from all of these other satellites to give us that global picture.
Dahlia, good morning. It's John Wells.
Hi.
Hi. I've been watching with a tremendous interest that ever since the satellite was launched. It's very exciting. Correct me if I'm wrong. If you're sitting in front of the TV and you're watching the weather before the satellite and you're seeing some sort of pattern coming in from Hawaii heading towards California, all we're really looking at is clouds because all the different types of radars really don't go more than maybe 100, 150 miles past or outside of the West Coast or outside of the East Coast. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. So weather satellites, like, you know, we see the clouds moving all over the world. They sit about 22,000 miles up, and they take a look at one picture of the globe, which is why we can get this really good accuracy of where the clouds are. But then they kind of infer what's happening below the clouds to get estimates of rainfall. So if you take an example like a storm system moving from Hawaii, you know, these satellites that are in this constellation and GPM core are sitting pretty low at about 250 miles up. And so they can provide this detailed structure of precipitation, actually looking at the individual drops in the clouds.
Again, looking at the layers, the type of rain, maybe if it's sleet, if it's snow, and actually what's going on. So this really is a game changer. Also, correct me if I'm wrong, the TRMM, which is the Tropical Rainfall Measuring Mission, which is sort of the satellite for researching and monitoring precipitation, it only takes measurements between 35 degrees north and south, so that when Hurricane Sandy was charging up like a freight train up the Atlantic waters, that the TRMM could no longer observe the storm, missing the opportunity to observe the storm's transition from a tropical to a mid-latitude storm. Now we're going to be able to track that all the way. Is that correct?
Exactly. And that's one of the key features we're really excited about is the ability to look beyond the tropics to kind of expand upon what we know in the tropics to look at, for example, extratropical systems. And actually, GPM, the core observatory, provided its first images of what's called an extratropical cyclone, so a big weather system that exists above the tropics east of Japan. And so we were able in that to see a combination of light rain and heavy rain as well as snow and ice. And that's that is the first time we've been able to see an extratropical storm in three dimensions over the ocean. So that was really exciting findings that just came out in March.
Mm, that's good stuff. Now, this spacecraft with the satellite was launched the end of February from the southern part of Japan. Why was it launched from there versus from here in Florida?
Well, you mentioned that, TRIM, the Tropical Rainfall Measuring Mission, and TRIM, as well as other satellites, have started this amazing international partnership between NASA and JAXA. And so as part of that partnership, we're continuing it with GPM. NASA provided the actual spacecraft. They built it at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center here where I am in Greenbelt, Maryland. And they also provided one of the instruments, the X-ray-like instrument. And JAXA provided the dual-frequency radars that are on board, and their agreement was also to launch it, which is the same agreement that we had with TRIM. And so that leverages assets, and we're able to get more for our money. But also, it kind of continues this international partnership to look at a truly global issue of where and when our water is falling from the sky.
Exactly. Now, since the satellite's been out, you all have been working around the clock, calibrating, testing, getting ready for this new hurricane season. How are things going?
Things are great. As I mentioned, you know, we had our first images released March 25th, and it does show both instruments working great, and we are continuing to put the satellite and the instruments through the ringer to test all different aspects of them. And as we're kind of preparing, we just want to make sure that the instruments are measuring precipitation accurately, and so as we move into hurricane season, we'll have never-before-seen images of storms both over the oceans and hopefully, or not so hopefully, over land.
Dahlia, we've come a long way. This week is the 49th anniversary of the first commercial telecommunications satellite that was ever launched, the Telstar. Telstar's still up there. It was about 75 pounds. This satellite that you have launched, the GPM, is what is it, 8,500 pounds?
It is pretty large. In fact, if you think of it kind of in terms of size, it's actually sort of the size of a small corporate jet. So tip to tip, you think about how the wingspan of that, and that's when the solar arrays are extended. And it's also the length of about a small school bus. The weight of it is actually quite large. It's I'm just trying to look up the statistic, but it's several thousand pounds.
Exactly. And tell me just a little bit more about the collaboration. There's a lot of instrumentation on GPM, but as you mentioned earlier, it is also polling other devices, other satellites out there, collaborating data and providing this more comprehensive picture. Tell us, how many other devices is it collaborating with?
Well, there's a range of different satellites that are part of this international constellation, and you know it can range from about 8 to 10, depending on what instruments and satellites are part of this. But you know they range from everything from looking at the tropics with a satellite called Megatropique, which is an India and France mission, and look at very narrowly around the equator to see what's happening with tropical convection and storms. You have satellites that are orbiting through the poles, polar orbiting satellites, such as SUMI NPP, which is a NASA NOAA mission. And so what's really amazing about this is that each satellite has instruments on board that are designed for much different things. But because they have this reference instrument that you can kind of relate to, which is the X-ray type instrument, the GPM core can take that data, and in our ground system here at NASA Goddard, they're able to pull all of that information together to get this uniform picture. And that's huge for understanding everything from freshwater resources to natural hazards like floods and landslides, and all the way down to weather forecasting, what's our weather today, and what's our climate going to be in the years to come.
So let's talk about, like you say, floods and landslides, other natural disasters. How can it, you know, for example, with the landslide in Washington, the recent last month, how could that have helped us predict that when it was going to happen and to what extent?
Right. So it's interesting because my other research focus is actually landslide modeling. and so I did take a little look at this event. And you know, this area had a lot of instability prior to this very unfortunate and catastrophic landslide. And much of that is due to both the type of material, you know, you have lots of glacial material, but also because of the rainfall. And so what we were able to observe with the TRIM satellite, we have a composite kind of image or information that goes up to 50 degrees north. And so with that, we were able to see that this was actually a much wetter season than most of the seasons we've seen on record in this area. And it was a kind of a wet late in the season. Now with GPM, GPM will actually be able to fly over those areas, unstable areas, everything from the Rockies to the West Coast, even the Appalachians and the East Coast. And so we'll be able to get much more detailed measurements, for example, over mountains and areas where we've traditionally had a really, weather satellites have traditionally had a really difficult time measuring precipitation. And so the goal is as we get better, we'll be able to get a much better understanding of how much rain is falling over these susceptible regions and when we might experience these types of huge events.
Dahlia, there are hundreds of terrestrial-based Doppler radar systems in the United States that are providing coverage for weather in the different regions. Will they be going out of business?
Not at all. It's so important to have ground validation or ground truthing. So the gauge network that we have around the world, as well as the radars, is fundamental to being able to link what we see from satellites in space to what we experience on the ground. And so that connection is how we improve what's called the algorithms or the models that allow us to estimate rain on from the satellite instruments. And so a combination of those is really important. But what I think a lot of people, as you mentioned before, don't realize is that these ground-based systems really don't extend very far if you're looking at the globe. So
No. All
of the rain gauges in the world can only fit in about 2 basketball courts. And the radars, while they have a better coverage, there's issues in mountains, and there's no radars, as you mentioned, over the oceans. And so by having this global picture, we're able to kind of fill all these gaps and get a much better global understanding of our rain and snow around the world.
Fascinating that two-thirds of the world is water, and up until now, we really don't know what's been going on over it.
Well, I think that we do, you know, but the point is to try to improve upon what we already know and expand the bounds of understanding how we can get better estimates of rain and snow. And so what we're very much hoping, and all signs point to that, is this new data set that we'll be able to provide from this global constellation of different satellites will actually provide the best global data set of precipitation that we've ever had.
Hmm. So you mentioned before being able to measure precipitation on each of the poles as well. What is this going to do for, you know, how are climate scientists looking forward to this to be able to further chart climate change?
Right. Well, it's really, really important to know when, where, and how much it's raining or snowing around the world, because we need to know what's happening, you know, today in our backyards. But understanding precipitation and what might happen in the future is still a huge challenge in a lot of climate models. And so what this type of data will do is provide kind of the fundamental information and also the long-term or somewhat long-term record to be able to both understand what's happening with climate models today and yesterday, and then how we can project into the future. So, you know, it's estimated that some areas might get wetter, some areas might get drier, but there's still a lot of, you know, models that range in those estimates. And so the goal of this data and providing it now is to improve both our weather forecasts for those, you know, for what we see on the evening news, as well as what we might expect in the future and where we might be getting more extreme both precipitation and lack of precipitation.
Right. Now, as we see on the evening news or when we talk to the folks from NOAA, you know, they always say you can't look out more than a week. Will this really help us look out beyond a week? Because the bottom line is, you know, maybe we can't still predict the pattern where the flow will be, or will we be able to?
Well, this satellite is part of a fleet of different instruments, both ground-based and satellite-based, that NOAA uses to make their forecasts. And so right now, actually, NOAA is taking in this data, this early release data, to get a sense of how it will contribute to their weather models. And so we're really interested to hear how we can how this might help to improve weather forecasting kind of in the bigger sense. And it's not just NOAA. You know, around the world, other weather forecasting centers are looking at this data to see how they might be able to improve what the characterization of the individual particles, called the microphysics, the individual particles, and from that kind of looking from there to the entire storm system. And that's something that GPM will provide and hopefully help to improve the forecast to some extent.
You know, it's interesting that that all these countries are cooperating, working together. You know, all you do is hear stories about how we're not doing that very well. But here, it doesn't seem very political. We're sharing this information with all the other countries, and everyone's really kind of working together.
Well, now it's amazing that you know, NASA's data policy is that it's all open data, and I think that you know, it's crucial to work with other international organizations as well as other domestic, you know, agencies as well. You know, we can't do it alone. And, you know, there's a lot of other weather agencies. There's a lot of other international agencies that all want to know where it's raining. And so by being able to kind of leverage all of these different, you know, instruments and satellites, it really helps us to get a much more complete picture that we couldn't do, you know, as just one agency or with one satellite.
I'm assuming that as these instruments require software updates, that we're going to be able to do that from here, from the ground, give, you know, software updates and things. As new technologies come out or new instruments and those sorts of things, are we going to be able to go up and upgrade this system, or do we have some additional satellites that are on the drawing board right now?
Well, there's always a satellite on the drawing board. You know, the goal of NASA is to push the bounds of what we understand and try to get better. You know, in terms of the actual updating of this the satellite, you know, we're not quite there yet to make actual upgrades. But software is a tremendous fix. You know, we're able to do things with the TRIM satellite that's been up for almost 17 years that we had never dreamed possible when it was first launched in 1997. And one kind of cool thing about this satellite is it actually uses the TDRS network, which is tracking data relay satellites, which sit all around the world, all satellites around the world. And so the GPM core is constantly in contact with one of these satellites. And so it continually sends its signal, which bounces off of these what's called TDRS satellites down to a ground station and then back to NASA Goddard to process. And that whole process can take about 15 minutes, which means that we can have near real-time data on the nearest hurricane or the, you know, most severe storm that we have within, you know, an hour or 2 hours of the satellite actually taking the picture. And the same is true with uploading software. So we're able to kind of make those changes much more quickly than sometimes other satellites that have kind of a regular downlink, but it's not as frequent.
You are so enthusiastic about this. It's really refreshing to talk to you. I mean, you're so excited. I'm excited about this thing.
Well, thanks. We're thrilled to have it launched, and the launch went very smoothly. And seeing the first data, you know, at all of the scientists that are working on this and the engineers, it's been a long road to get here. And we're just very excited about how this can change the playing field in understanding precipitation around the world.
Now, you've been working on this for about a decade, is that right?
Yes, over a decade. Not me personally,
yes.
But the team has, yes.
Yes, you sound too young to have worked on it for a whole decade. But are there any skeptics out there? I mean, I would imagine that most climatologists and weather people are salivating about this. Are there any skeptics and critics?
I mean, not that it's come across my desk, but I mean, I think the most important thing is that NASA's in the business and the satellite is in the business of providing information, and everybody wants more information all the time. You know, what can we expect on our trip to work? Do we need to leave more time? You know, should I bring an umbrella today? You know, should I buy beachfront property in, you know, somewhere that the ocean isn't close to right now? So, you know, everybody just wants more information, and so that's really our job, is to provide the data and information that can help us make informed decisions in the future. And so I think that really is the most important thing about how this is going. So that, you know, that's it.
Now, I know we're mostly talking about measurement of precipitation, but other natural disasters, we're just getting ready to talk to someone about the supervolcano in Yellowstone. But in terms of, you know, earthquakes and volcanoes, things like that, is there anything that this satellite will help us with in terms of that?
You know, this the data is really kind of more focused on, you know, meteorological or hydrological hazards, so floods,
right,
and landslides and drought. But, you know, I think it's really important to understand the bigger picture. So, example, how do aerosols from volcanoes affect precipitation?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's actually something that other satellites at NASA are looking at and monitoring. And so having all of these Earth-observing satellites together can give us kind of that bigger picture of, you know, what's happening above the surface, what's happening below the surface, and in our atmosphere.
Right. Now, I was curious about any of the existing weather satellites that we have out there that are going to be part of this comprehensive picture. What had to be done to retrofit those to be able to hook up, you know, to the GPM?
Yes, well, that question is definitely directed towards the person that's creating this merged product. But the satellites, the weather satellites that sit about 22,000 miles up, give or take, are they use infrared information, so infrared energy. And so they actually are still used to fill holes where we don't have kind of lower orbiting satellites providing data. And so they're critical to kind of getting this consistent picture. And so to take all of those different satellites and all the different measurements and the ground-based system that we're able to kind of calibrate from gauges and radar around the world, that whole process is actually being done by the NASA science team, and it is not it's not simple, and it takes years for development, and so we're very much hoping that by the end of this year we'll have that global merged product, But the amazing thing is that because we'll have that really complex model, we can actually go back and what's called reprocess or look at all of the data mm-hmm. back to when TRIM started in 1998 and get that long-term, multi-decade picture of rain in more accuracy.
Oh, that's good.
Oh,
that's good stuff.
It's all about big data and understanding what's there, right?
Well, and if you think about a hazard, you know, it's nice to know what's happening now with the weather, but you want to know kind of historically what's happened over time. So it's kind of our climatology. And so when you have this long-term record, it's really important to understand everything from extremes, like, you know, when do we last have our major floods or landslides or huge storms? And so by having that long-term record, it's critical for both weather forecasting, natural hazard forecasting, and climate modeling into the future.
Yeah. Dahlia, we'd love to have you back on maybe after the close of this hurricane season to
sure.
tell us about what you have learned.
Absolutely. It'd be my pleasure.
And one final question, Dahlia. You sound so excited about what you do, and I suppose any young aspiring scientists out there would all say, I'd love to work for NASA. How did you get into it?
You know, I do have to say that I studied a lot of math and science, but internships and the ability to kind of talk to the scientists here, I think, was the thing that opened the door for me to learn about what NASA does and how I could get involved. So there's internship programs across the country, both at NASA and other organizations, for everybody from high schoolers to college and above. And that really helps you kind of get on center and see what's happening. So I would absolutely encourage those individuals to kind of see what types of internships are out there for working at NASA.
Oh, that's such a great tip. Thanks.
Lynn, it sounds like she may be a TERP fan.
Well, I'm very close to the University of Maryland, but unfortunately I didn't do any of my studies there.
Yeah, I went to College Park, did my undergraduate there.
Right down the road from
And Greenbelt, of course, we're through there all the time, and Goddard has just really, really grown up, hasn't it?
It has. You know, GPM was really developed at NASA Goddard in addition to at JAXA, and it was the largest satellite that NASA Goddard has ever built and assembled, so that was pretty exciting. And we continue to do more to think of new missions and develop new technologies. So we're really excited about the future.
Well, Dr. Dahlia Kirschbaum, thank you so much for joining us today. It's exciting, and you make it sound even much more exciting.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Again, that was NASA scientist Dr. Dahlia Kirschbaum and the new GPM Core Observatory satellite telling us everything we ever wanted to know, literally, about precipitation. Pretty exciting.
It is very exciting.
This is Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back with Jacob Lowenstern. He's the scientist in charge of the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. We're going to hear about that super volcano. Will it erupt? Will it go away? Stay tuned.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
The Spur Bar and Grill is proud to support KPCW. Located down the alley at 352 Main Street, the Spur is open 7 days a week starting at noon for lunch, après-ski, dinner, drinks, and dancing. The website, thespurbarandgrill.com, includes music schedules, menus, and contact information. Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Brett Stimson, mortgage assistant for home purchases, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peak. Well, we just spoke with Dr. Dahlia Kirschbaum of NASA Goddard Space Flight Center about this exciting extreme weather satellite, the GPM. And we are waiting to get Jacob Lowenstern on the phone. He's the scientist in charge of Yellowstone Volcano Observatory, and we're going to be talking about the super volcano at Yellowstone National Park. And let's see.
You liked that satellite. You were really excited, almost as excited as she was, about talking about how we can come up with new measurements of precipitation and what it will tell us. I think you grasped that concept.
Well, I heard about the satellite a couple of years ago when they were still, you know, first working on it. Well, not first working on it, but getting ready. And it just intrigued me because the granularity of data and what this new satellite's going to be able to provide is really a game changer.
Yeah,
it's cool.
Yeah, that's good stuff.
And I wanted to mention that my daughter Jacqueline, it's her birthday today, and she is listening in from Boston, Massachusetts.
All right, happy birthday, Jacqueline.
And happy birthday.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with John Wells.
We sit here in Park City and we look around the world, mudslides, hurricanes, tsunamis, tornadoes that are a mile in diameter. You know, it's no wonder that we're feeling pretty safe here in Park City. But 300 miles from us is one of the largest supervolcanoes in the world. I understand there's 6 supervolcanoes and this is like one of the largest. If this thing ever erupted, I think the whole West goes. But our next guest, when we do get him on the line, we'll be able to talk to him about it.
That's right. And I'm curious to know how it ties into, you know, we've recently been hearing more and more about this potential earthquake along the Wasatch Fault.
Yeah.
This is a really significant fault running about 300 miles north to south along the Wasatch and as far down as Richfield, I believe. And of course, this month on April 17th is the Great Utah Shakeout. Now, it's a nationwide emergency drill, and it's designed for emergency preparedness. I never really thought about it until I started to think about what would happen if there were a major earthquake in this area. What's our plan?
How far is that fault line from Park City?
I think just a matter of 10 or 15 miles, really. So we've got some figuring to do. So look into this, folks. You can Google the Great Utah Shakeout. And again, it's on April 17th. You can find out what you can do to be prepared. And this comes down to things like communication. All communication would be wiped out, say, if there were a major earthquake. How would you communicate with your kids, your loved ones? So how about that? Looks like we have Jacob Lowenstern on the phone, so why?
Well, I think we should probably begin. Yellowstone National Park. It's just up the road, 300 miles. But it sits atop one of the world's largest supervolcanoes. It was struck by the largest earthquake in over 30 years several weeks ago. Gives rise to the concerns about the supervolcano Yellowstone Caldera. Could it erupt? And how has the supervolcano changed over the years? And what could it possibly tell us about the shifting geology as far south as Utah? Joining us to talk about the Yellowstone earthquake and supervolcanoes is Jacob Lowenstern, the scientist in charge of the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. Welcome to Cool Science Radio, Jacob.
Hi, great to be here.
Yeah, great to have you with us. What's going on out there?
Well, it's been a little bit more active than typical, but nothing too anomalous for Yellowstone. Yellowstone is, as you just said, it's a volcanic system, and it's pretty regularly has earthquakes, and the ground moves up and down, and it's an exciting place to work.
I understand a friend of mine called me and said that he saw some footage of bison that were stampeding down the road prior to earthquake. It wasn't an eruption. How do animals know about this stuff?
Well, in this case, I don't think they did. It was about
was that a hoax?
It was a bit of a viral video. Actually, it was filmed by somebody who lives in the area, and he posted it innocently as, "Look at the bison running around in spring."
Right.
They were heading into the park. And anybody who goes to Yellowstone sees bison running around pretty regularly. So It got reposted by somebody with a crazy headline of Yellowstone bison fleeing impending eruption. So a lot of people got excited about it and sent it around, but it was kind of much ado about nothing.
Well, thanks for setting us straight on that.
Right.
So wondering, Jacob, you sit up there in the, do you work full time up there in the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory?
Well, the observatory is actually, it's a virtual observatory.
Okay.
There is no building. It's eight different organizations, including the University of Utah in your neighborhood.
Right.
They're the ones who run the seismic network. I work for the U.S. Geological Survey. My office is actually in Menlo Park, California. And so we, with the state geological surveys and various other groups, universities, we collaborate to monitor Yellowstone. So I'm in Yellowstone, anywhere from a month to 2 months a year, but my home base is back in California.
Okay.
I've read that supervolcanoes can erupt spontaneously without the need for an external trigger such as an earthquake. I really don't know very much about a supervolcano. Can you tell us about them?
Well, supervolcano is a term that gets placed on any volcanic system that has had an enormous eruption in the geologic past, so what's called a super eruption. And those are basically just based on the size, the amount of material that comes out of the ground, sort of the largest scale of eruption in a single event that can happen. And so if you've had one of those eruptions, you get called a supervolcano. It's a little bit funny because in some ways, systems or volcanoes that have never had one are in some ways more likely than ones that have already had one, but you don't get called it until you've already had the eruption.
And
in any case, I'm sorry, they're really big eruptions, but what triggers them, what causes that, nobody actually can really say. The last one was 26,000 years ago.
The last one in Yellowstone Park was 26,000?
No, the last one, I'm sorry.
Anywhere.
The last one on Earth was 26,000 years ago. That was in New Zealand. There was another one 74,000 years ago. That was in Indonesia, a place called Toba. The last one, Yellowstone, was, this is the super eruption variety, was 640,000 years ago. So a long time ago. Yellowstone has had lots of eruptions since then. The most recent volcanic eruption at Yellowstone, much, much smaller than a super eruption, was 70,000 years ago.
Okay. And I'm wondering, in these other locations around the world where there have been super volcanic eruptions, do they also leave the thermal activity and the geysers behind, as has done in Yellowstone?
They certainly can. The location in New Zealand is called the Taupo Volcanic Zone. And all of that area has geysers and all sorts of thermal activity. So that one is definitely an example where they do. The Toba system in Indonesia is a lake mostly, so there's a little bit less thermal activity, at least that you can see at the surface. But, yeah, it's pretty common when you have that much material beneath the earth, that much molten rock or what we call magma, that the heat from that rises. And it heats up the groundwater system, and so you get lots of hot springs.
Okay. So we're about in Park City, maybe a five-hour drive from Yellowstone, something like that, 5 to 6.
300 miles.
And wondering when the supervolcano 640,000 years ago erupted, you know, did the lava make it down this far into the Wasatch?
It would have come as ash. It would have come in the form of ash that would have gone way up into the stratosphere and then circulated along winds. You know, the winds would have moved it. And, yeah, you would have seen some ash. It's difficult to say how much. I don't know if there are any, you know, collections that were done in your area, but it would be on the order of probably a few centimeters. You know, a couple inches of ash would be sort of what you would expect for a worst-case scenario at Yellowstone.
The guest that we had earlier was Dalia Kirschbaum of NASA Goddard Space Flight, talking about the new GPM satellite that has just gone up that's going to be able to help forecast extreme weather. What is new on the technology side for forecasting earthquakes?
Well, forecasting earthquakes, nobody, you know, what we do is probabilistic modeling. Basically, you look at how often earthquakes occur in a given area, and so you can fit something about general recurrence intervals. The other thing that's the big new thing in earthquake monitoring is what they call real-time warnings, and that's based on the seismometers that are closest to the earthquake can detect the movements, and warnings can be sent at the speed of light, much faster than the actual waves of earthquakes move through the ground, and so you can get utilities, for example, to turn off power. You can make buildings safe in the few seconds that you have warning. But that's pretty much the state of the art right now in terms of earthquake forecast. There is no near time predictions that are done that would you know, be plausible at this point in time.
And the where the earthquakes have been in the past compared to the fault lines, does that how does that come into play with the fault lines?
Well, what you do is you look at you can do geological studies along faults and determine how often those faults have ruptured in the past, and certainly that's been done near Salt Lake City along the Wasatch. It's done in California, and so you can say, well, there was a large earthquake at this date and at this date, and you can start to put a record together for that particular fault, how much it slips in each event, and what sort of the long-term rate of movement is, and then compare that with what's been happening recently, and you can get some sort of a predictor on whether that fault is kind of behind in its movement and is likely to move again, or that it is, you know, the most recent earthquake was most recent enough that it isn't likely to happen again soon.
Jacob, the recent earthquake in northern Chile, that was a couple weeks ago, there were so few fatalities from that, and I think, you know, the credit was given to construction, seismic construction and upgrades, and just preparedness. Talk about that a little bit. Is that kind of what went on there, or was it in an area that was so rural that there wasn't much damage?
Well, you're getting a little ways away from my expertise in particular, since I'm a volcanologist, but I do know that in Chile they have pretty good building codes. It's a fairly well-off country, and they've really put emphasis on to making sure that their buildings are safe. Obviously, it was also in far northern Chile where the towns are smaller.
Right. Okay, well, that's a pretty good answer. I mean, that's exactly what I had heard, but just wanted confirmation. But since you're a volcanologist, there we go, let's get back to volcanoes. And I think I saw something about the possible the term they used was dying of this super volcano in Yellowstone. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, it's a possibility. To think about Yellowstone, it's a system that more or less has been active not at present-day Yellowstone, but in the Snake River Plain, which is, you know, the part of Idaho, southern Idaho. That entire geological region has been active for about 16 million years, and as the plate has moved, the tectonic plates move, and the plate has moved over to the southwest, which has caused a whole series of volcanoes to be present over time, the most recent of which is Yellowstone. Mm-hmm. So all of these volcanoes lived their life and eventually died. And Yellowstone itself has now been active for 2 million years. It's had three very large eruptions and lots of smaller ones. And so it's perfectly reasonable to say that Yellowstone has pretty much done what it's going to do. And if there's going to be new volcanism along this Yellowstone hotspot, it's going to be 1 million years away or 2 million years away and somewhere to the northeast if it continues as it has in the past.
Okay.
Jacob, how'd you get in this business?
I went to college and went on, got a graduate degree in geology, and I got excited about volcanoes along the way. Was able to do some fun research around the world, and got an opportunity to work for the USGS after graduate school, and haven't looked back.
So that all sounds pretty fun and interesting, especially when you get to make regular visits to Yellowstone and look at the thermal activity there. And it must feel so much more alive to you than it would the average tourist that goes to Yellowstone.
Yeah. I'd say, you know, we definitely have a greater appreciation for what we're seeing, maybe. But everybody can enjoy Yellowstone. There's so much to see there. And it's so the sorts of things that you see at Yellowstone are so much out of the norm. You know, you just don't walk around the streets in your hometown and see boiling groundwater or bison and grizzly bear. And so, you know, everybody, I think, can appreciate Yellowstone. And I certainly do. I've been working there on and off since I was a teenager, so it's an amazing place.
That's great. So at the end of the day, we, even though there was this small earthquake in Yellowstone, it seems as though earthquakes cannot be implicated in possible supervolcano eruption. Is that kind of the conclusion?
Well, I guess you need to think of it this way. Earthquakes are always happening at Yellowstone. The Hayden Expedition in 1871 had a swarm of earthquakes when they were visiting on the north end of Yellowstone Lake. We get 2,000 to 3,000 earthquakes sometimes per year in Yellowstone, and a 1,000 earthquakes a year is kind of a low number for Yellowstone. So this is the way the system works. There's boiling groundwater. There's molten rock down there. It pressurizes the system, and for the most part, it just passively loses its gas and heat, and it takes a little bit of earthquakes for that to happen. But the last eruption was 70,000 years ago, and so clearly it can do all of this without erupting, and it has, and it will continue to do that. So we are there to monitor the system, to provide information on what's currently happening. Right now, there are earthquakes. The ground is moving up again, and that's something that we often see there.
Right,
but it's not necessarily reason for alarm.
Okay, quick question before we let you go. Out there in the southeast corner of Idaho, there are the craters of the moon. I don't remember what the names of the volcanoes are, but out there in the desert near Arco,
yeah,
I'm sure you've studied those. When did those erupt, and is there any activity happening now there?
Well, there are occasionally earthquakes out there. The last eruption was about 2,000 years ago, so it's a system that's erupted much, much more recently than Yellowstone has. And my understanding, I'm not an expert on that location, but my understanding is that there's been an eruption there every couple thousand years for the last 10,000 years or so. And so it's certainly a place that we could see new volcanic eruptions coming out of the ground, and they wouldn't cause a lot of regional harm to anybody, but they certainly would be an interesting event.
And we're speaking with Jacob Lowenstern, scientist in charge of the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. Jacob, thanks for joining us today on Cool Science Radio.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Jacob.
Okay, well, we will be back after these messages. You're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
The Winter Sports School in Park City is proud to sponsor the Youth Winter Sports Report. We are currently accepting enrollment applications for 2014, our first year as a Utah State Charter School. For more information, wintersportsschool.org or 435-649-8760. The Winter Sports School is a nonprofit organization.
Here's a question for you. Would you rather hear your new baby's first cries in the hospital or in the backseat of your car on the way to Salt Lake? Hi, I'm Amy Roberts with Park City Medical Center, where we have a dedicated maternity staff and state-of-the-art labor and delivery unit just minutes from anywhere in town. Park City Medical Center. Because when you're in labor, a short drive to the hospital can be the difference between your doctor delivering your baby or your spouse doing it. Park City Medical Center is a nonprofit community hospital and part of the Intermountain Healthcare family.
Additional funding for news and information on KPCW has been provided by University of Utah Healthcare, located at Redstone, 435-658-9200, redstone.uofuhealth.org. Peak Art and Frame, custom frames, mirrors, shadow boxes, art, 435-649-0801. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with my co-host Lynn Ware Peak. Well, we've had a fun show today.
Oh, yeah. I mean, really, the more that we can quell our concerns about a super volcano erupting in Yellowstone, the better. It's just interesting, though. It's, I think, seeing it from Jacob Lowenstern's perspective, like, as he says, you know, there's all this thermal activity and geysers and so much going on beneath the ground. We only see the ramifications of that above the ground when we when we witness a geyser. So it's pretty interesting to think about.
And I'm feeling pretty safe, you know, with mudslides and hurricanes, tsunamis, tornadoes, all these different things going on. And of course, friends of mine that live on or close to the water on both coasts here in this country, I'm feeling pretty safe here in Park City.
Me too. The odd avalanche.
Yeah.
And that's about it.
What I really enjoyed was talking about the new GPM satellite, and Dahlia was just so enthusiastic about it.
Mm-hmm. That's the thing. Every scientist we talk to on this show, it seems, is so into their work. It makes me think I should go back and become a scientist.
You'd be a good one.
So would you. All right. Well, thanks to our guests, Dahlia Kirschbaum of NASA and Jacob Lowenstern of the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory.
And we also want to thank our sponsor, San Francisco Design, Prudential Real Estate, Peak Art and Frame. And we'd be remiss if we did not mention Beth Fratkin, our producer. We want to thank her as well. A quick promo here tomorrow on Fun Friday. James from the Wasatch Brew Pub, you are listening to KPCW Park City. NPR is next.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Doctors say a student wounded in yesterday's stabbing at a Pittsburgh-area high school is in very critical condition after he had another operation overnight and may need additional surgery. Authorities say a large knife pierced the 17-year-old's liver. It barely missed his heart and aorta. The victim is not being identified, but his 16-year-old alleged attacker is. Police say Alex Reibel is being held without bail in a juvenile detention center, charged as an adult for attempted homicide and aggravated assault. Police say he wounded 21 students and one adult with two kitchen knives. A manhunt is underway in Central Florida for a 26-year-old who allegedly crashed his SUV into a daycare center at an Orlando hospital yesterday. One girl died. Several other children were critically injured. Police say the suspect struck a convertible with his SUV, jumped a curb, then slammed into the KinderCare facility. A federal appeals court in Denver hears arguments today on Utah's same-sex marriage ban. Terry Gilday with member station KUER reports a judge struck down the ban last year, ruling that it was unconstitutional.
Three gay couples sued Utah over its law banning same-sex marriage. Among them, Derek Kitchen and his partner. They'll be in Denver today to hear the state's appeal.
We're happy to have the public debate because it's creating conversations around the country and around Utah. And I think that these conversations are really pushing people to accept gay and lesbian people, and that's a good thing.
Attorneys for the state will argue that marriage is primarily an arrangement for procreation, and the state needs to protect that interest. The three-judge panel will consider Utah's case today and a similar case from Oklahoma on April 17th. For NPR News, I'm Terry Gilday in Salt Lake City.
The head of the nation's Health and Human Services says 7.5 million Americans are now signed up for health care coverage under the Affordable Care Act. Secretary Kathleen Sebelius's tally announced on Capitol Hill today exceeds the number announced by the White House last week by about 400,000. The number of Americans to file new claims for unemployment benefits has dropped sharply, falling about 9.5% last week. NPR's Craig Windham reports that was the biggest decline in claims since 2012.
The Labor Department says new claims for jobless benefits dropped to a seasonally adjusted 300,000 last week. That's the lowest level in nearly 7 years. There was also a decline in the four-week moving average of claims, which is less volatile than the weekly number. Economist Stuart Hoffman says the downward trend in unemployment claims in recent weeks bodes well for the job market.
We know that layoffs are falling, and if you get some additional hiring, that's the way you get more jobs, more people hired, fewer people laid off.
Hoffman says the encouraging report is the latest sign that the economy is rebounding from the effects of an unusually harsh winter. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
Dow's down more than 100. This is NPR. The president of Russia is warning Europe that if it does not help Ukraine with fuel assistance quickly, the former Soviet republic may end up siphoning off Russian supplies intended for European nations. Vladimir Putin has sent a letter to 18 European leaders urging them to prevent a shutdown of Russian natural gas to much of the continent. He says Ukraine's mounting gas debt is forcing the Kremlin to begin demanding advance payments for gas supplies. Russia is in a standoff with Ukraine and its allies after it annexed Crimea and showed signs of doing the same in other parts of Ukraine. Afghan intelligence officials claim they were able to disrupt 90% of Taliban plots to derail last weekend's historic elections. NPR's Sean Carberry reports more than 250 suicide bombers were arrested and 65 car bombs defused in 5 weeks before the vote.
Intelligence Department spokesman Lutfullah Mashal says a number of Pakistani militant groups were coordinating with the Afghan